From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. ambassador to South Korea receives 80 stitches after a knife attack. Considering new sanctions against Russia, the disappearance of journalist Austin Tice in Syria.
We know that he's not held by ISIS. We know that he's not held by any terrorist group. We know that there has been no ransom or concession request.
And African Americans recall the 1960s fight for voting rights. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The U.S. ambassador to South Korea received 80 stitches in his face after he was attacked by knife-wielding assailant this morning in Seoul. VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Patton reports the attacker is an ultra-nationalist political activist who claims he acted alone.
Ambassador Mark Lippert underwent surgery at the Sinchon Severance Hospital in Seoul to repair lacerations to his face and left hand. The hospital director, Jung Nam Shik, says the ambassador needed 80 stitches to close the deep gash to his face.
얼굴 상처는 오른쪽 광대뼈에서
He says the scar on his face is about 11 centimeters long and 3 centimeters in depth, located from his right cheekbone to jaw. And he says, fortunately, there was no major damage to his facial nerve or salivary glands. Doctors also treated his thumb and two fingers on his left hand that were cut during the attack. Lippert wrote on his Twitter account that he is doing well and is in great spirits. The ambassador will likely remain under observation in the hospital for 3 to 4 days. Lippert was attacked by a Korean assailant with a 25-centimeter-long knife while attending a forum on Korean reconciliation. The organization that hosted the event, the Korean Council for Reconciliation and Cooperation, is a coalition of various groups that support the peaceful unification of the two Koreas. The group's director, Lee Sang-hoon, is denying reports that the assailant, 55-year-old Kim Ki-jong, was a representative from any of the member groups. He says Kim was able to gain admittance by taking advantage of a bureaucratic oversight, saying he was from an old group that no longer exists but remains on the organization's list. Lee apologized for the breach of security but says they did not think there was any cause for broader concern. He says it was an annual event and there had been no such incident like this in the past, so they did not request extra police for cooperation, especially for security. Kim reportedly told police he acted alone. When he attacked the ambassador, he reportedly shouted, "South and North Korea should be reunified." In a recent blog post believed to have been written by Kim, he blamed the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises currently underway for preventing the reunions of families that have been separated since the end of the Korean War in 1953. North Korea recently cited the joint drills as the reason why they would not permit the reunions to take place. South Korean media reports that Kim has a long history of ultra-nationalistic activism and violence that includes burning a U.S. flag on the embassy grounds in Seoul in 1985, staging one-man protests against Japan over disputed islands, and attempting to light himself on fire during a protest in front of the presidential Blue House in 2007. Police say Kim was arrested in 2010 for throwing concrete stones at the Japanese ambassador and received a suspended 2-year jail sentence. There are also reports alleging Kim visited North Korea 6 times between 2006 and 2007 and that he tried to erect a memorial in Seoul for the late North Korean leader Kim Jong-il in 2011. South Korean officials condemned the attack, calling it an unacceptable, harmful act and a very serious crime against the envoy representing South Korea's most important ally. The South Korean Defense Ministry says the attack will not affect the ongoing joint military exercises involving thousands of troops from the United States and South Korea to prepare for a possible attack from North Korea. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
A top U.S. official says Washington could impose new sanctions on Russia if a month-old Ukrainian ceasefire reached in Minsk continues to be violated. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, told U.S. lawmakers Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin's government continues to fuel the fire of violent separatism in eastern Ukraine.
The United States and the EU have worked in lockstep to impose successive rounds of tough sanctions, including deep sectoral sanctions on Russia and its separatist cronies, as the cost for these actions. And those sanctions are biting deeply on the Russian economy. The Minsk package of agreements, September 5th, September 19th, and the February 12th implementing agreement offer the promise of peace, disarmament, political normalization and decentralization in eastern Ukraine, and along with them, the return of Ukraine's state sovereignty and border control in the east. As we have long said, the United States will start to roll back sanctions on Russia when the Minsk agreements are fully implemented, and so will our European partners. But as the President has also said, we will judge Russia by its actions, not its words. And we have already begun this week intensive consultations with our European partners on further sanctions pressure should Russia continue fueling the fire in the east of Ukraine or in other parts of the country, fail to implement Minsk, or grab more land, as we saw in Debaltseve.
Debaltseve, a strategic transport hub that links the rebel-held regions of Luhansk and Donetsk, fell to separatist forces last month. Newland says the conflict has killed 6,000 people and displaced 1.7 million others. The commander of U.S. Army Europe, Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, says some 12,000 Russian troops are supporting the separatists in eastern Ukraine, while 29,000 Russian troops are stationed in Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula Russia annexed from Ukraine last year. Russia analyst Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the problem is Russia is convinced the West is not serious about confronting Moscow over its Ukraine policy.
They look what's happening in the Iranian nuclear negotiations, where from the Russian point of view, Americans keep making concession after concession. They look at the weakness of the European Union. So until they become convinced that they've reached the end of the line and that we're really going to do something for the Ukrainians, and I don't mean the kind of level at which we're at right now, and the fact that they have almost $400 billion in reserve from the heady days when oil was well over $100 a barrel, and that they're winning. And so that, I think, is the core problem. They just don't believe that the United States and the Europeans are going to get serious about doing something. And meanwhile, this is really reinforcing Vladimir Putin's popularity at home. He's at 84%. So he's saying, I think I'll take a little bit more risk here. And that's what he's been doing, because he doesn't see it as particularly risky. And it's a sad thing.
What alterations in U.S. policy do you think are warranted at this time?
The problem is the only thing that would really work against Vladimir Putin, because after all, the Germans have extensive trade with him, the Greeks have made good relationship with him, and so forth. I think it would be the threat that we actually would significantly beef up our NATO presence and consider that Ukraine, which is not a member of NATO, at least have some kind of credible threat, because the Russians are winning. And they're going to continue to win, and this bolsters Vladimir Putin. And remember, he's facing serious problems. The ruble is down 50%. Price of oil is down 50%. There's demonstrations at home. He is doing this as an offset. This is really buttressing his position. So I think we'd have to have some much more credible notions of either serious support for the Ukrainians, but they also need to be trained, or our European allies to get much more serious, because thus far, we like them, and they're really doing good things in other areas, but this is not an area that they're used to. They're used to the United States taking the lead.
Meanwhile, Russian opposition activists say they will publish documents gathered by opposition leader Boris Nemtsov before his February 27th murder that purported to show Russia's direct military role in Ukraine. Leslie Templeman-Holmes, another Russian analyst at the University of Melbourne in Australia, believes the opposition's documentation may be very damaging politically to President Putin.
He has so far been a so-called Teflon president. We've used that term in other contexts, for instance, with President Reagan. But Putin has been particularly capable of dealing with any opposition. However, his country is in problems now, partly because of the sanctions, partly because of the marked decrease in the price of oil. He's got serious economic problems, a 50% decline in the exchange value of the ruble, for instance. That, added to what's likely to be damning evidence, is going to start a whole new ballgame, in my opinion. That I wouldn't put it past him that he can survive, but he's going to be in more trouble now in the next few days, in my opinion, than he's been for years.
That's going contrary to what other analysts seem to be indicating, that he's at 84% popularity. Why the sudden turnaround, in your view?
If it's proven that there really are Russian troops, contrary to what he and his foreign minister Lavrov have been saying all the time, he comes across as a complete liar. Now, of course, there will be a number of Russians who say, well, that's fair enough. Ukraine should be, always has been, closely linked with Russia. Of course, they were together in the USSR and the Soviet Union. But there will be a number of other Russians who will feel, well, he's been lying to us all this time. So far, he's been given the benefit of the doubt by most Russians because they wanted to believe him, because they wanted to believe that Russia is a great power again.
So, ironically, Mr. Nemtsov's murder may actually turn against Mr. Putin.
In my opinion, it already is. Putin is very worried that the kinds of revelations that are going to come forward are not only about Russian soldiers' involvement in eastern Ukraine, but also a lot of hard evidence about corruption. Alexander Navalny, who's probably the best known of all the Russian anti-corruption activists, said that these will be damning and very concrete pieces of evidence against the regime, not just Putin himself, but others as well. And let's not forget that this is one of the major factors that brought down Yanukovych in Ukraine a little over a year ago.
Ohm says if he could advise the West, he would counsel patience until the opposition documentation is released and the official Russian investigation into Nemtsov's murder is released. He says it is possible ultra-nationalists outside the Russian government could have been responsible for the killing. He believes the best course is even tougher sanctions if government officials are implicated. Reporters Without Borders is conducting a Free Austin Tice campaign to secure the release of the journalist missing in Syria. Delphine Algaw is spearheading the operation, and we asked her who Austin Tice is.
Austin Tice is an American freelance journalist who was working and reporting in Syria for McClatchy, Washington Post, among other media. When he disappeared in Syria near Damascus in August 2012.
Do we know where he is or who has him?
No, there is quite a level of uncertainty about his kidnapping, but we know who is not holding him. We know that he's not held by ISIS. We know that he's not held by any terrorist group. We know that there's been no ransom or concession request. And according to many diverse and credible sources, he is alive and treated pretty well.
How does your campaign work? What do people do?
So Austin Tice's parents asked Reporters Without Borders' help to launch a public awareness campaign to raise awareness about the unanswered kidnapping of Austin and to do everything possible to bring it back home. So we invite all American media to partner in the campaign to help us to and offer us banners on their media support. But also we invite any citizen to take part in the campaign by signing the Free Austin Tice petition, but also to take the blindfold page. The blindfold is the symbol of Austin unanswered kidnapping, but also the symbol that when a journalist is missing, we are deprived of information. We are ourselves blindfolded. So that's this campaign was just launched, and we continue to run until Austin's safe return.
Now, can people go to your website and sign up for this petition?
Yes, the website is freeaustintice@rsf.org.
And how has it been going so far?
We had an amazing support from the media, the Washington Post, Gannett, USA Today, the Atlantic Media Group, the McClatchy newspaper have been partners of the campaign, which means they give us millions of digital impressions for digital ads on their website. The New York Times and the Washington Post offered us a full-page ad in the print newspapers. So it's really the first time that we observe such a mobilization of the American media to raise awareness about the missing American journalist.
Now, Syria is a very bad, difficult place for journalists.
Yes, Indeed, Syria has been the most dangerous country for journalists since the start of the conflict in 2011. And it's really important to highlight that most of the journalists killed, arrested, detained, or kidnapped are Syrian journalists. And the Western journalists, maybe we pay a lot of attention when something happens to them, but we don't have to forget that the Syrian journalists have paid the highest price in this fight for freedom of information.
Delphin Algo, U.S. Director for Reporters Without Borders. U.S. President Barack Obama and thousands of people will gather in the small southern U.S. city of Selma, Alabama, Saturday to commemorate the 50th anniversary of a historic voting rights march that became known as Bloody Sunday. For VOA Television, Chris Simpkins traveled to Alabama and introduces us to some of the foot soldiers of the voting rights struggles of the 1960s.
Hundreds of peaceful African-American demonstrators marched for voting rights in Selma, Alabama, 50 years ago.
As the civil rights demonstrators made their way across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they were met on the other side by a group of state police officers who attacked them.
The violent images outraged the nation, drawing national attention to the denial of voting rights for millions of African Americans.
I had to go to the courthouse, stand in line, and vote.
50 years later, civil rights activist Nims Gay returned to the Birmingham courthouse, where he and other blacks questioned white county officials who rejected their constitutional right to vote.
What you're really trying to do is intimidate these people, and by making them stand in the rain, keep them from registering to vote.
Why do you think you're superior to me? Don't you realize from one blood all nations flow? Or is that something you don't understand? And see, that irritates them. But see, don't let worry about nobody. Irritate nobody. When you're right, you're right. And when you're wrong, you're wrong.
Following legal challenges, blacks were allowed to vote. He says the fight was hard but worth it.
A voteless people is a hopeless people. Don't care whether you're black, white, green, or gray. If you can't vote, you're messing up.
Retired teacher Gene Smiley was among the first blacks allowed to vote in Montgomery, Alabama.
A lot of people around in Montgomery and surrounding areas, so many of them were really afraid to go and try to vote.
If you had a job, just trying to register was enough to get you fired. And in addition to that, they would even fire some of your relatives.
Days after Bloody Sunday, Hank Sanders marched with Martin Luther King and thousands to Alabama's capital, Montgomery.
The power of the vote seemed so powerful to those who had it that they didn't want anybody else to have it. And they were doing everything they could. They were using every mechanism at their disposal to stop them.
The accomplishments that we made didn't occur by themselves.
Civil rights lawyer Fred Gray, who represented King, won a court ruling to allow the successful march from Selma to Montgomery.
It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life.
Gray says less than 5 months later, President Lyndon Johnson signed the 1965 Voting Rights Act into law.
Voting rights was a key because it opened the door for so many other things. Because if you get people to vote, they can elect individuals to office. These individuals who are elected to office have the power to appoint hundreds of other people to elective office.
I do believe.
Back in Birmingham, Nims Gay sings the civil rights anthem that inspired him and so many others in this struggle for equality.
The Lord is on our side today, deep in my heart.
Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Birmingham, Alabama.
We shall overcome someday.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, under fire for using her personal email address to conduct official business during her tenure as America's top diplomat, says she has asked the State Department to release her emails. "I want the public to see my email," Clinton said late Wednesday in a brief Twitter message. "I asked State to release them, and they said they will review them for release as soon as possible." State Department spokeswoman Marie Scharf issued a statement saying the agency will review Clinton's emails using a normal process that guides such releases. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. You can also re-listen to this program or yesterday's program or the program the day before that, as far back as you want to go. That's at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab and look for International Edition. As usual, I'm Susan Yockey, reporting to you from Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 5th, 1496, King Henry VII of England issued letters to Italian John Cabot and his sons, authorizing them to explore unknown lands. Cabot is believed to have been the first European to set foot on the North American continent since the 11th century. Cabot's ships disappeared during a third exploration voyage, and most historians presume that he was lost at sea. In 1770, five civilians were killed in Boston, Massachusetts, when harassed British soldiers opened fire after being hit by thrown objects. The incident is seen as an indication of increasing hostility between American colonists and the mother country. Within a decade, the colonists would declare independence from Britain and fight a war to gain nationhood. On this day in 1933, newly inaugurated U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt responded to a growing banking crisis by declaring a national bank holiday. He suspended all financial transactions for 5 days while the administration and Congress wrote legislation designed to ease public distrust of the banks. Also on this day in 1933, Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party received 43.9% in parliamentary elections. Although not getting a majority, the Nazis used their high vote count to later pass the Enabling Act, which set up a dictatorship with Hitler in charge. In 1940, a recommendation for the secret execution of more than 25,000 leading Polish citizens and military officers was sent to Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. The order was dated March 5th. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Echoing the UN Commission of Inquiry's February 20th findings on the range of regime atrocities against Syrians, Human Rights Watch and the Syrian Network for Human Rights confirmed in late February, for the third time in less than 1 week, the Assad regime's continued widespread use of barrel bombs. The Syrian Network for Human Rights estimates that the Assad regime has used barrel bombs more than 5,000 times. These shrapnel-filled oil drums, equipped with a fuse, are dropped from low-flying airplanes or helicopters and have killed and injured thousands of Syrians. These credible reports from late last month highlight the daily horrors facing Syrians and further expose Bashar al-Assad's insulting and blatant lies to the media and his citizens that regime forces don't use these crude and vicious weapons. The Assad regime inflicts daily terror on the Syrian people with barrel bombs, which have killed an estimated 12,000 people, mainly civilians, said State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. To bring an end to these horrors, we remain committed to holding the Assad regime accountable for its crimes against the Syrian people and to working towards a negotiated political solution that stops the bloodshed and secures a future of freedom, justice, and dignity for all Syrians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.